In August 2017, my wife and I attended our first online Radical Dharma webinar with Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, Dr. Yasmin Sedula, and Lama Rod Owens. This inspired my wife to buy a copy of their co-authored book by the same name. This book is absolutely electrifying as it speaks to the longing that I have to be of benefit, and it reflects my understanding of the power of love and compassion as radical ways to approach and address social inequality. Today, I am honored to bring you a collaborative episode with one of these three great teachers, Lama Rod Owens. He brings his deep study and practice of the Dharma into everyday life and shares with me his reflections, not just as a Buddhist, but as a Black queer man in America. In our conversation, Lama Rod brings it back again and again to the importance of doing our own work. He does not shy away from confronting the ways in which we sometimes use our experiences of marginalization to avoid looking at how we are privileged. He also speaks strongly about how love galvanizes us rather than anger, but that our anger is actually pointing us to our woundedness, which is to say, where we need to be doing this work of love. Thank you, Lama Rod, so much for joining me today. I really appreciate this opportunity to collaborate with you.
Absolutely, thank you.
So a lot of how I've shifted the format of Everything is Workable has been a direct response to the guidance from the co-authored book, Radical Dharma, that you wrote with Angel Kyoto Williams and Dr. Yasmin Sedula. And notably, one of the things is sort of setting the scene for the point at which my guests moved from I am suffering into there is suffering. And so when in their lives they kind of took on the role of being advocates or activists, and in some cases bodhisattvas, if that's the word that they'd like to use. So I want to encourage listeners to read Radical Dharma because they can learn a lot about you and your work and your engagement in depth. But could you talk a bit about home leaving specifically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think home leaving is such an integral part of entering onto the path of Dharma. And for Dharma practitioners, our primary example of home leaving really began with the Buddha himself, who actually had to leave his home in order to engage in the path of awakening. This home leaving, it's not just a physical leaving of one's home, but it's also this metaphorical leaving. You know, so in general, once we begin to develop this deep desire to move beyond suffering, we actually have to begin the process of letting go, of moving out of the places that we've been put in order to get a perspective on how to relate to these places that we just in the past thought as being very solid or very like rooted. So to leave both physically and metaphorically means that we understand that, you know, where we've been put isn't where we can stay. That the path is about moving beyond these places into another place.
So how was the experience of home leaving for you sort of something that pushed you in the direction of where you are now and what you're teaching right now?
Yeah. Physically, you know, I grew up in the South, and for me growing up in the South, growing up in the church, I never fully 100% identified with the place I grew up, nor in the religious tradition that I was raised in. I always felt like an outsider. And when I finally got to a place in my life after I completed college where I was like, okay, I can actually leave the South now. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew that like in order to become whoever I was hoping to become, I actually had to leave the place that I grew up. Interestingly enough, you know, my mother, when people asked her, you know, why was she letting me leave our home community, you know, she would say because there's nothing here for him. Mm. And I found that to be so deeply insightful for me as I was preparing to leave, and this was in my early 20s, you know, the South and to come up north to New England, that my mother really had that wisdom and that insight to understand that, like, I was actually doing this because I realized that there was absolutely nothing there for me to engage in that would be fruitful for me. It reminds me of Gertrude Stein's quote, where she says, "There is no there, there," you know. And of course, you know, if you know, like, the context of that statement, Gertrude Stein was actually talking about Oakland, California, where she was born and raised. And she went back then when she was born, you know, she was born in this rural part of Oakland, and all of Oakland was rural. And then she went back, it was all developed. She was like, well, where I grew up isn't there anymore. And so I think about that quote quite often for me, because in terms of home leaving, I realized growing up in my home, it was like after a while, there was no there. And then I knew I had to go somewhere else, and that made all the difference.
I that resonates with me so much. I think for anybody who travels or leaves the place of their birth and spends any significant time away, you really, like, that impermanence and that letting go, right? Like, it becomes starkly obvious when you go back and see the change that has happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, I had this profound privilege to do that leaving. And so I took advantage of that and decided to leave. I think it's hard to get a perspective of how you've been raised and the ways in which you've been conditioned if you don't know how to step out of that location in order to look back to get a fuller, wider view of the context that you come out of. I think for anyone starting the path, I mean, we have to actually be really serious about how do we leave where we've been put.
Yeah, totally. It's that being able to observe your experience from a different space and from a breadth of understanding coming from interacting with different people in different places, even if it's like the next state over, that can make, or in my case, the next province over, that can make a huge difference. So you mentioned in the first webinar that I attended for Radical Dharma, which these are brilliant, by the way. You mentioned that much of your work right now is around misogyny and sort of growing awareness of that. And I think this is another part of that home leaving. And so for me, as a white person, I'm doing a lot of work to address my own racism and views of white supremacy and how they show up, like, really subtly. And it's a difficult practice, right, to examine privilege and inequality and the implicit beliefs that we hold and how we benefit from these things. So it's really made me appreciate the challenge of working with self-deception or with ignorance, one of the three poisons. Could you talk a bit about what this work looks like for you and the tools and supports that you're using in your practice?
Right. Yeah, you know, so patriarchy is something that I've really begun to invest quite a bit of energy into. And for me, being a Dharma practitioner and studying the life of the Buddha and the development of the early Sangha, so much of the community formation was around misogyny. You know, it was the way in which the female body was cast as being an obstacle for enlightenment. And I think that's really important for us to not over-romanticize the Buddha and to say, well, he was this really, like, forward-thinking person. He was, but he also knew that he had to mirror the society's treatment or relationship to the female body in order for the Sangha to survive, you know? So there was a deep, deep unwillingness from the part of the Buddha to consider women, especially female renunciates, equal members of the Sangha. And it took a lot of convincing and work by Ananda and the early self-formed community of female renunciates to convince the Buddha to allow women into the Sangha. And even then, they were allowed into the Sangha as a subclass under male renunciants. So I understand that, like, that's deeply embedded into the development of Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And as a male practitioner, first and foremost, it's really for me to understand the context in which my practice has emerged and has been informed, and also to understand the privileges of being in the male body and how this tradition celebrates the male body, and to do the work of exposing that and divesting from that kind of enjoyment or that kind of unconscious involvement in that particular paradigm. So I use the practice, especially meditation, to look at the ways in which I am manifesting misogynistic views and behaviors through various means, and developing strategies to undo those things from manifesting in my experience and outwardly towards others.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the experience as well that you have as someone who is queer around that sort of patriarchal misogyny as well within the communities of gay men often?
Yeah. And that's, you know, I think misogyny is so intense within gay male communities. I think gay male communities really are distracted by this particular identity location of sexuality, and that somehow being gay or queer is equal to being female bodied. You know, there's this belief that there's the same kinds of disprivilege that are happening. And because of that, there's a deep, deep unwillingness to examine particularly cis male, a cisgendered male privilege within gay community. Gay communities. And so I think we often see misogyny expressed in the ways in which gay men criticize female bodies, the ways in which women are excluded from gay male spaces, the continued privileging of gay male issues within our larger queer community, particularly white gay male issues and needs. And so all that continues to play itself out, and really, these conversations that we have to start having is that misogyny, patriarchy are still rampant within our communities, despite our marginalized sexual identities.
What are the things that you turn to, or like what sort of guidance do you use for yourself when you're entering into one of those conversations? Because those conversations are not comfortable to have.
Yeah. I say that our positionality in the world, you know, we have to actually begin to look at the various experiences that different groups within the queer and gay community are having, and to say, like, how am I actually enjoying a lot more privilege than certain other sub-communities within our community? And I think that for me, when I engage in these conversations, is often, particularly with white gay men, is always this argument of saying that, you know, oh, it's still hard being gay. And I say, you know, that's very true, absolutely, but at the same time, there's this whiteness that interrupts the full kind of expression of marginalization for white gay men, you know. And yes, there's been a lot of psychic trauma, there's been a lot of emotional trauma. That's absolutely true. That's been the case for all of us. But how are you still gaining access to resources and to spaces that many of us still aren't? White gay male couples are the highest earning sub-community within the queer community.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, a lot of white gay male couples, not to overgeneralize, but in my experience within my circles, are doing pretty well.
It's definitely something I'm like, yeah, you know, I not that I think that we should rank suffering, but being a white gay man is not necessarily one of the hardest marginalized groups to belong to.
Well, and you know, then the other aspect of this is that I think white gay men use sexuality as a bypass to look at whiteness and cisgender privilege.
That's great. Is that brings me to you talk about healing in Radical Dharma, and you actually have this wonderful statement. You say, maybe we believe that the right to healing is only for those who have been hurt or oppressed, and we are upset to consider that the one who hurts and oppresses is in just as much need of healing. For me, that's a profound teaching on compassion, but it's something that a lot of people struggle with when we really lock down around categories of us versus them, oppressed versus oppressor, friend versus enemy, and who's deserving of what, without sort of seeing that intersectionality of our experience. So could you talk a bit about how you came to this understanding and what you mean by it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think unhappy people create a lot of suffering for all of us.
Yes, the Republican president.
Yes, yes. You know, a Republican president, you know, and I look at someone like Trump, for instance, and I'm like, you're not happy. This isn't an expression of happiness. And happiness is more, it's not just about skipping around singing Disney songs. You know, it's not that kind of euphoric, visceral kind of expression of bliss. When I talk about happiness, I'm talking about contentment, being at home in our experience, like being in our natural state, which holds this incredible space for all of our experiences to be present. And so I know when people aren't experiencing that spaciousness, because there's aggression, there's tightness and contraction within the mind itself. And then there's a solidifying of all these emotions. And then there's a really harsh kind of reaction.
A lot of fear in that contraction, right? Yeah.
It's deep fear. Deep insecurity, you know, and that's how unhappy people create suffering for not just themselves, but for all of us. Because that fear is actually a mechanism to deeply isolate the ego. That I exist, this is what I need, this is mine, and you are other, and therefore you become my enemy. You're in direct competition for the resources I need, and so I'm going to do what I can in order to always make sure I have what I want and need. And that's the violence that begins to emerge. You know, that simple thought that I need to protect myself. So much of identity-based violence emerges out of our belief in a certain identity and our terror around that identity being impacted.
And I think that also, like, that sense of contentment in yourself is something that you can have it with certain parts of your identity that you're willing to look at. And then, that whole ego clinging, protection, fear, lockdown comes up around the other parts of yourself that you're not willing to look at. So you could be like, yeah, I'm very content in my identity. So for me, as like a queer person and as a woman, but I see that I have a lot of work to do around whiteness. And that if I can't heal the work around whiteness, if I can't deal with things like my implicit biases, then I can't have that sense of contentment as a whole person. So it's like how you see it in relationality with other people, but also how you see that within yourself and the things you see in other people that you don't like about yourself and don't want to look at.
Right. You know, and for me, entering into Dharma, like that was one of the things that I really began to understand, was that when someone hurt me, they have to be in suffering in order to conceive of hurting me in such a way. And I began to establish relationships with people who were experiencing authentic happiness. And I began to see the difference. Like when we're experiencing authentic happiness or an authentic being within our own experience, there's this extreme willingness to allow people to be as they are, to be in ways that are healthy for them. and not this intense need for us to attempt to control, dominate, criticize, force, or in any way get people to align with our own needs and desires.
From here, I mean, like, that's when you're talking about sort of the work of love, right? And yep. Love as a full-bodied acceptance of the humanity of yourself and of other people.
Right.
And I find that really striking and wonderful about what you bring to the Radical Dharma conversation over and over again. Like, you really talk about how love is the thing that galvanizes us rather than anger.
Yep.
Could you speak a bit about this?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And you know, for me, again, I say this all the time, but like, it's just really bizarre that most of the time, all I do is travel around talking about love. Because I was so suspicious of love growing up. You know, I talk about this in Radical Dharma, like conditional love is like one of the most violent acts that I experience in my life. And so when I came into, you know, studying Dharma and practicing, I began to understand that love was like, first and foremost, wanting myself to be happy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it was so hard because I didn't have a lot of examples of being in relationships growing up where people just wanted me to be myself and to be happy. People just wanted me to do things that made them happy. Mm-hmm. And so when I started wishing myself that this one, Rod, experiences deep well-being, happiness, and joy, that became the spark of tremendous kinds of spaciousness within my own experience. And allowing myself to show up completely naturally helped me to allow other people to show up as themselves completely. And that's my wish of happiness, for others to be happy, including myself. It's just like, I want you to be right now in this present in your body. And I don't want you to feel unsafe. And I want you to feel as if you're able to do the things that promote the healthiness and the balance that you need right now in this moment. And I want to be very sensitive to the ways in which I create obstacles for you getting the things that you really need. And that's what love really is. It's this kind of deep, profound ethic of well-being that we're always contemplating, that we're always living moment to moment for ourselves and for our relationship to others.
Yeah. And I think as well that love is not just a feeling, but it's actually action that is born from that sense of absolutely recognizing that another person's well-being is intrinsically linked with your own well-being.
Yep.
Yeah. And I think from there, then when you're doing that kind of practice, I don't know like what you use. I use metta is usually the thing I do when I find I'm locking down around somebody. But my experience is a sense of then being able to speak and act in ways that are loving, in which case you're sort of like, you can confront someone's limited ideas and their ignorance without confronting them as a human being.
Right.
To kind of move on from that sort of place, I think you've talked about the common problem in activist communities of policing whether or not other people are woke enough or they're doing work well enough. And I see a lot of policing around love. I see a lot of it. I see a lot of don't tell me to love people.
Like, yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
So what guidance do you give to people for responding to that kind of messaging, and how do you respond to that when you encounter it?
Yeah, it's a tough position to be in because we can use these messages of love as a form of colonization.
Yeah.
You know, and so people respond like that to being told to love because it sparks a trauma of continued colonization. Mm-hmm. That, again, there's someone else coming into our lives and telling us to be a certain way, and we never have space to figure out who and what we are. And so I think that often is very unskillful to move into activist spaces and always saying, okay, you need to love, because we carry all this trauma around that word. And activist spaces, sure, yeah, I don't necessarily use that language. I don't actually just walk around talking about, you need to be loving, you need to be more compassionate, because I know that's triggering. It was triggering for me before I started a direct practice of love and compassion. And so what I tend to promote is an ethic of self-care. Mm. So how do we actually make choices that helps to minimize the discomfort that we experience in our daily lives? How do we minimize the anxiety, the sadness, the despair, the hopelessness? And how do we begin to make small choices to promote an alleviation from these discomforts? How can I think a little bit about giving something to myself that will actually help me to be more sustainable as I continue to work on the behalf of others? And that's how I actually talk about love. And I think that's also about compassion. Compassion is wanting people to be free from suffering and also wanting ourselves to be free from suffering. You know, and so really it's me moving to communities and saying that, like, you can be actually even more beneficial to our movements, to our causes, to the organizing, if we can actually learn to work and create ways of minimizing the discomfort that we experience, because if we don't minimize the discomfort, we actually begin to enact these kinds of discomforts on others and within our communities.
With that as well, in Radical Dharma, you make it really clear in the liberation section that having a practice which compels you to insert yourself in the world as an activist. So like you say, our activism has to be about equipping ourselves with the tools to mm-hmm. have conversations with people who are closest to us. Mm-hmm. So it's that sort of, like, if your home ground isn't good and solid, then how could you extend? And I think as well, like what we were talking about a bit earlier about that intersectionality, you can have good home ground in certain areas and you can mm-hmm. extend that. And then other parts of yourself, you know, are too wounded, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What are the things that you use to work on that woundedness, or that you mm-hmm. suggest for people to work on that woundedness?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the first things is to understand that our anger is actually pointing us to our woundedness. Many of us are just really pissed off and angry and enraged, and that nature of that anger, that rage, is directly related to our experience of woundedness mm-hmm. and hurt. So learning how to move through the anger to contact that woundedness is the first thing that I do to work with my woundedness. When I get there, I allow myself to experience what the hurt feels like. And, you know, I'd say, oh, I am experiencing this really deep woundedness right now. I am experiencing sadness. I am experiencing despair. I am experiencing hopelessness. And I want to become really familiar with how that feels, because honestly, I don't know how it feels, because I've been so conditioned to avoid feeling this kind of discomfort that I actually have no familiarity with it. Mm. You know, so we deeply, deeply feel what that's like for us. And then we begin to use all kinds of different techniques and strategies to work with it. Of course, for me, it's been from the very beginning, metta practice, loving kindness practice, and really understanding that there are beings who love me and learning how to deeply take that love in. Because in my early practice, I realized that I continually sabotaged receiving love. Mm. You know, that I couldn't let people be nice to me. I couldn't let people express authentic love for me, because I was so traumatized from all the ways conditioned love had been thrown at me. So I just kind of shut down completely to love. And so my healing began with learning to be loved.
Mm. You know? Well, what was the support that you had around that? Because I think, like, one of the things that we can do is, we hear this a lot, like, you need to sit with the woundedness, you need to sit yeah. with your anger, your anxiety, whatever. But for so many people, that's just a very re-traumatizing experience. Yeah. So how do you move out from being re-traumatized by it to actually creating a container to hold it and look at it?
Mm-hmm. Space is such an important part of this practice. So for me, it's getting a lot of space, you know, not focusing, not fixating on the woundedness or the trauma, but like getting really spacious around it, understanding that this is just an experience, but it's not who I am. Mm-hmm. So I am not self-identifying with the hurt. So I am not hurt. Rather, I am experiencing this hurt. That gets space around these experiences, you know, and it helps us start taking the experiences of hurt and trauma less seriously. That at the heart of our trauma, at the heart of our woundedness, there is this, there's emptiness. You know, there's, it's actually, it doesn't exist. That's a really intense kind of teaching, but we get there slowly, bit by bit, by not self-identifying.
Yeah.
You know, and it begins to change. Like our orientation to the woundedness begins to change when we understand that we are not the woundedness, that the woundedness is just this experience, and that we already are whole, but we've invested so much energy in this belief that we're somehow not whole and that we're fragmented. So that was really the core of my practice, is just saying that this is just part of my experience. I am not sad. I'm just experiencing the sadness, and I am not being punished for anything. I am not a bad person, you know, but this is the reality of being human. Mm-hmm. And embodied, that I actually have to learn how to relate to the traumas of being human.
When people are doing this kind of work and then starting to embody it and step out into the world with it, what are the supports and guidance that you give to people when they're engaging these kinds of conversations with people who they're going to be in conflict around, people who aren't, mm-hmm. aren't doing the work of looking at their woundedness? Cause I think there's a point where we say some people just don't waste your breath, but there are other people where, say you're in an opportunity where there is some willingness, you know, like if I encounter racism within another white person in a Dharma space, so at a Dharma center, even if I don't necessarily have a direct relationship with them, I'm like, well, we're in a Dharma center, so I'm gonna assume that you at least want to do some work around cultivating awareness, or you probably wouldn't be here. So what kind of guidance do you give for people to speaking with people who aren't necessarily noticing that woundedness and not doing the work around it?
I think first and foremost, I think it's important for us to simply model what it means, what it looks like actually to be embodied and to be engaged in the struggle of trying to move through these kinds of biases and ignorances and the ways in which we enact violence on others. People need to see an example of what it means to be actively engaged in the conversation with ourselves and with others. And that happens just by people just looking at you, you know, witnessing you. You know, just noticing how you're responding and how you're being in the world. And that's a tremendous kind of teacher. I don't engage in the conversation as much as people think I do. I think first and foremost, because I know that before I can have a meaningful conversation, you have to be at a certain space. You have to be at a certain level.
Yeah.
You know, you need to have learn from your experiences. You need to have read the books, you know, you need to be willing to understand that you have work to do and that we can't expect others to do our processing for us. So I don't start the conversation with folks who aren't at that basic level, mm-hmm. you know, and at least people have to be willing and have to know that, like, they have to be somewhere else. That they know that, like, they don't know everything and they're open. If they're not open, then for me, the best teaching is just simply being in relationship to them and just being myself. And in doing so, giving them permission to be themselves. Okay. You know, and then people begin to disarm. So, like, I'm from the South. I go home to the South and it's, like, full of people that, like, aren't interested in talking about white supremacy.
Yeah.
You know, But you know what? I can have really fun, interesting conversations with these people. It reminds me of the Saturday Night Live skits last year with Tom Hanks on Jeopardy that like everyone was like really praising. And I found it to be brilliant because I was like, oh, that's exactly what happens to me when I go home. You know, because in the South, you talk to everyone.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter. So like you can just be walking down the sidewalk and some like older white man will just pull you to the side and just be like, hey, how you doing? You know, blah, blah, blah. And you'll just have this conversation. Meanwhile, this person, this guy can be in the Klan.
Yeah.
You know, it's as stark as that. And for me, in those situations, it's not skillful for me to be like, listen, you're really fucked up. I just like, you're benefiting from centuries and centuries of white privilege, and like you need to really do the work and undoing that. That's just really not going to be effective.
It's not skillful.
It's not skillful, you know? But instead, I want people to simply see me deeply embodied. And I want people to understand that, like, whatever violence you throw at me in terms of, like, prejudice and discrimination and judgment and microaggressions, I want people to see me work with that skillfully.
Yeah.
And to say, like, I want people to see me literally on the spot deflect that and to say, yeah, you've just said this, you just done this, but, like, that's not who I am. And this doesn't have to be something you explain, it's just something that you do.
Yeah. It's the act of love, right? Love is something that you do. And if you're being loving with people, it's that unconditionality, right? I accept you as a member of the clan.
Yeah, it's like you do what you need to do. And yes, there may very well be a situation where I have to do much more than just simply be. Mm-hmm. There may be, as an act of love, a situation where I have to defend myself.
Yeah.
Or stop you from doing something that enacts violence. But until that happens, we skillfully work with one another on the spot within the moment itself. I think a lot of marginalized folks, we spend too much energy fighting fights that are meaningless. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's just pointless for us to always be so hypersensitive and hypervigilant.
Yeah. So back to that self-care thing.
Yeah. Yeah, every battle is a mind to fight. Every march for racial justice, I don't have to show up for. Like, I just have to learn how to conserve my energy and to understand that, like, to ultimately understand what my real work is.
Yeah.
And so that when we start asking those questions, it gets really complicated. You know, it gets really complicated and complex. And one of those really intense complexities for me has always been around gay marriage. I think these ways of thinking can also be really applied to the ways in which gay marriage was touted as like, oh, this is the last great battle that the queer community has to fight. When indeed, so many members of our community are still struggling for basic access to resources.
Yeah.
You know, like having the right to choose a gender or not to choose gender, to have access to healthcare, disabled subcommunity within the queer community are, you know, folks who really are struggling to have a voice and access to resources. And, you know, disabled folks in our larger community, definitely, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny how those with more privileges within a marginalized community just kind of sell beyond, you know, the rest of us. So even then, how do we work skillfully in having these conversations with members of our own affinity groups and our own affinity communities? It's like, well, we have to say, yes, we're all marginalized, but we're all actually experiencing very different levels of access to resources. And can we talk about that?
Yeah.
And can we talk about identities that carry privilege, you know, and how that actually is something that has to be divested from in order for true community unity to emerge?
It makes me think about what you were saying I can't remember if this was in Radical Dharma or somewhere else that I read it, where you were talking about when you first began to teach and your original idea was like, people are going to meet me where I am. And you very quickly realized, oh no, I have to meet them where they are. I have to like be open to that. And that's where you find that affinity and you have that, yeah, being able to relate to people across your experiences of both marginalization and privilege, and that very few people are only experiencing marginalization and very few people are only experiencing privilege. That we, mm-hmm. we all have multiplicity in ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Absolutely.
So what are some, this is like closing question I always ask my guests, mm-hmm. what are some tools or guidance or gifts that you would like to offer to listeners who are doing this kind of work?
Mm-hmm. Patience. Patience is really at the heart of transformation. We're so conditioned to want things to happen really quickly. And we actually have to learn to slow down in order to have the space and the time to do the work of transformation. There's immense suffering happening here in America, such immense suffering with our government, with our president, with, of course, you know, the natural disasters are happening all over the world, especially here.
Climate change. Know,
climate change.
Right.
You know, it's terrifying. It's climate change, the assault on healthcare, the privileging of the wealthy. You know, I can go on and on. Of course, you know, systematic racism, systematic patriarchy, everything, mm-hmm. you know. And for me, it's really about helping people to understand that there can be a kind of happiness even within this kind of intense struggle right now and intense anxiety. But we have to, at the end of the day, learn to be patient and learn to just continue to do the work, and that maybe we won't ever see an end to these social issues, or we may never actually reverse climate change. That's important for us to be aware of. Then we say, what's our true intention? Mm-hmm. Then if we can't reverse these things, maybe our intention is to minimize the suffering that so many of us are experiencing in the moment to moment, developing a relationship to these things that are quite unstable and volatile. That was the ultimate gift that Dharma has given me, is this incredible patience and this incredible wisdom that maybe I won't see all of my aspirations realized in this life. You know, but that doesn't mean I stop. It doesn't mean that I give up, because there are people who are suffering, and that's the point. To interrupt the suffering of sentient beings and to interrupt our suffering in order for people to have access to ways of transcending their suffering to achieve enlightenment eventually.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
To learn more about Radical Dharma and find out how to get a copy of the book, visit radicaldharma.org. To hear more from Lama Rod, visit lamarod.com. To find out more about my work in the world, to get in touch with me, or to become a patron, visit caitlinschatch.com. The link is in the show description. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott. Thank you to Tejai Moore of Moore Music for the original theme song.